With everyone fighting for attention, how can your business stand out and connect with customers? Easy, with Constant Contact. Constant Contact's award-winning marketplace platform has helped millions of small businesses stand out, stay top of mind, and see big results fast. It's okay if you don't know much about marketing. Constant Contact's writing assistant tools and automation features help you craft messaging and say the right things at the right time. I use this to help write and send my email newsletters, and you should too. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
My name is Jari Bolander. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Ethos Podcast. On this podcast, we're going to take a deep dive into the traits, values, beliefs, and skills of all sorts of entrepreneurs to learn how to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient world. Let's get started.
On this episode of the podcast, I speak with Amandeep Khurana. Right now, he's helping me out with the San Francisco chapter of Founders Network while he's plotting his next move. We talk about as a kid how he wanted to be an industrialist, which back then he didn't even know what that meant. Came to the U.S. for grad school in computer science and decided that he wanted to build stuff instead of getting his PhD. His first job was at AWS when it was around 100 people, and as it grew, he realized he wanted to do more. That led him to found his first company to solve the problems he saw customers facing. His curiosity, hunger to solve problems, and more importantly, the chip on his shoulder to be successful is what led him to the entrepreneur path. That inner force, which is hard to see, is what drives him to this day to build solutions to customers' problems. The hunger to succeed has been with him since he was a kid. His peer group brings it out in him even more. Being around other people who have the "we can do this" is one of the most powerful motivators for an entrepreneur. He also feels that his secret to success is that he's coachable and solicits feedback from people around him. This is especially important when you don't know what you don't know, and you're a pathfinder blazing a trail forward. This is both a gift and a curse because he really does not know when to stop. Now, let's get better together. Amandeep Khurana, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Jerry. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. No, I really appreciate you taking the time. I know sometimes, I mean, well, we all have a lot of time right now, but a lot of us are trying to, you know, connect at a different level. And not so much that we didn't try to connect with other people before, but, you know, you're also part of the Founders Network. You're actually part of the leadership team for San Francisco, and which I really appreciate because I'm supposed to figure out what we're supposed to do. And it can be a little crazy. But before we talk about all that and, you know, why we're big fans of Founders Network, can just tell me briefly about your journey as an entrepreneur and, you know, sort of how you got into it and kind of what brought you to San Francisco?
So there's a bunch of questions there. What brought me to San Francisco, my journey as an entrepreneur, what got me started? You know, I grew up in Delhi in India, and as a kid, you would ask me, what do you want to do when you grow up? I remember when I was like 6 or 7, something like that. For some reason, I used to say, I want to be an industrialist. I have no idea what that means. I think part of it was my dad had his own business, manufacturing medical equipment, specifically disposable syringes. And I think that was super fascinating and super exciting, like having a factory, and I visited the factory multiple times. I think that probably played a role there. And the idea that, you know, you create a business, you create something of value, there's a physical product that you're creating and putting out there in the world, was probably fascinating. I don't know exactly what about that was fascinating for me. He shut down that business later on. I pursued engineering and then came to the States for grad school. And the reason to come to the States for grad school was completely different. It had nothing to do with me wanting to be an entrepreneur. because I was also inspired by my uncle, my mom's younger brother, and he had pursued that path. So coming off of engineering, I said, you know what, I'm going to go do computer science grad school and go work at Google or Amazon and go work at a big company. So completely confused kid. That's the best way to put it. So I got here, went into CS grad school, coming out of, and somewhere along the way, I said, I don't want to pursue my PhD. I want to go build something. Got an opportunity to go join Amazon, and went to join AWS in 2010.
Wow. That's Seattle. Like the beginning.
Shortly after the beginning.
Yeah.
But yeah, all of AWS was a couple of hundred people at the time. I had no perspective on, you know, what enterprise software companies look like, what enterprise software looks like, why is AWS doing what they're doing, what are the alternatives. I mean, I do not know much. So went and joined AWS on one of the service teams as an engineer. I didn't enjoy the engineering component of my job. What I enjoyed much more was helping customers. So as customer requests would come in, I would get engaged. I would help the customers out, helping them figure out how to use the product, or if there's something going wrong in the usage and the operations are not working, just go help out, fix those things, fix the bugs. And a year into that job, a bunch of my friends were at a startup here in the Bay Area for Cloudera, and they had been asking me to interview at Cloudera, but I wasn't interested. Amazon was my dream job, and that's what I wanted to do. Before I joined Amazon, I was interviewing at Google and Facebook. And the moment I got the Amazon offer, I said, okay,
I'm out.
That's where I'm going. Yeah. That's where I'm going. That's what I want to do. So Cloudera, in 2011, they were, this friend of mine was recruiting me into, the field team and as a customer facing technical, engineer. Solution architect. Again, I did not know what that role really entails. Where does it fit in a company? Why is it important? Do other companies also have it? In my head, there was engineering, and then there was management, and there was sales, and that's all I knew. So, went into Cloudera with the intent that I'm going to try the solution architecture thing for a year, year and a half, and see if I like it. Because otherwise, I'm going to go back to engineering. That's what I'm trained in.
Yeah.
That's the thing that's most familiar. So I'll just go back to that. But I love being in front of customers and working with them on all kinds of activities, ranging from technical selling to delivery to enablement to messaging new products, going and figuring out how this new set of capabilities that are available, how would somebody use that, what use cases, et cetera, et cetera. So I just loved it. Did that for about 5 years, and I saw all the pain points that customers would run into. Again, didn't have any perspective on any of those things to start out, but over time developed a little bit of perspective on what's happening in the ecosystem, why is this pain point even there. So just started to kind of, like I said, just develop some perspective. 5 years into it, almost 5 years. I had seen some of the challenges that people were running into. And I said, you know what? I've had the big company experience. I've had the startup experience. And the startup was a stellar growth story. It was part of a complete rocket ship. So that was a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. And coming out of that, or thinking about what's next after that, like, I couldn't get excited about anything. I couldn't get excited about going back to Amazon or to Google, or I couldn't get excited about any other startup. Like, yeah. It's just nothing felt exciting.
Yeah. That can happen a lot. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so I found myself in this place. I said, I'm not excited about anything that's happening out there, which is weird. If I'm not excited about anything that's happening out there, then maybe I'm going to just go do my own thing.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so I started thinking about that and started thinking about what might that look like? If I was to go do my own thing, what might that look like? Would that actually fulfill me? Would that be a dream I would want to pursue? And the answer was yes. I said, fine, I'm going to take a shot at it. And started ideating, started looking for co-founders, and then ended up starting my company in 2016. Now, if you ask me, did I know that I'm going to go start a company when I was a kid? I don't know.
Well, you wanted to.
Moment? I don't think so.
You wanted to be an industrialist, whatever that means.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like I want to own a factory. You know.
Right. Now might be a good time to own a factory.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. Actually, I think now is a good time to figure out how to make stuff locally, and you know, have that capability, that capacity, especially with the disruption in the global supply chain, as they like to say, or the challenges. But so your dad owned a factory then back in Delhi.
Yeah, he was. Him and a few of his other partners. He wasn't the only person.
Does he still own it?
No, he shut down that business in early 2000s. So he shut that early 2010.
So would you say that sort of the entrepreneur stuff's in your blood, or because of what you saw your dad do?
I don't think so. I mean, my grandfather was in the army. He's a super conservative I don't come from a business family.
Okay.
So grandfather was in the army, my uncle is in the he actually just retired from the army. The younger uncle is also he's doing a job he's in Australia. So I would not call my background entrepreneurial in any way. In fact, if anything, it is more risk averse, and certainly not business minded.
So then. How did you end up doing it?
Like I said, I don't think I can tell you that it was in the blood and it had to happen.
Yeah,
you
know, I had the passion for it. Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Well,
I think it just came down to there's an opportunity.
Yeah.
I really want to go build something meaningful.
Yeah.
I'm going to go take a shot at it. Like nothing else feels exciting.
Yeah.
And that's it, right?
Yeah,
in love with the customer and go solve the problem for the customer. Like that's my view of the world.
Well, I mean, I have a similar background. Like my dad, his brothers. I mean, the only entrepreneur in my whole family, extended family included, was an uncle that was part of the. I think it was the East India Trading Company, out of the Netherlands. I think he was an import-export, and he lived in Singapore and Malaysia, and he did import-export, right?
None of them
have done any entrepreneur stuff. I mean, my two brothers work for the county of San Mateo. You know?
Okay.
My dad worked at United Airlines for a long time. My mom worked at a drugstore, it's like they sometimes ask, like, so exactly how do you, like, survive.
What happened?
I don't know. I mean, it might have been my grandmother, my mom's mom. She was always sort of entrepreneurial, but she never got to be entrepreneurial, I guess would be the word.
They
were from the Netherlands during World War II, survived the Nazi occupation, then went to Aruba. My grandfather was a doctor for Standard Oil in Aruba for a long time.
Wow.
And then they meandered their way to here. Lived in San Mateo, just south of San Francisco. And, I always say it was just like, I don't know how my mom and dad got together,
Right.
My dad's from Kansas. My mom's from the Netherlands. It happened and I'm here. But if you were to say like what I wanted to do, I think it's similar to you. What would I want to do when I was a kid? I wanted to be a fighter pilot.
Uh-huh.
And
it's way more exciting.
Yeah. Yeah. Fighter pilot or an aeronautical engineer working on airplanes, because my dad worked on airplanes. And it was only when I was in college, and I went to school at San Jose State. I think you were in college in Santa Cruz, right?
Grad school was Santa Cruz.
And I literally saw like all of my friends that were going to school, some of them were going to night school. They were like all working at Silicon Valley startups, all working in semiconductors. This is, wow, okay, I guess I'll go into semiconductors. And that's what I ended up doing. And so, yeah,
interesting.
It seems like you're just curious. I mean, because I'm curious, but it seems like that your kind of curiosity is the one that kind of drove you to this, because, you know, a lot of people I talk to, it's like, oh, my dad owned a business or my mom you know, whatever. But do you think it's curiosity? I mean, what trait do you think it is that kind of drove you or drives you now?
Curiosity is definitely there. I think the hunger to solve problems and find a way to make things happen is probably a bigger driver than curiosity. And frankly, I think there's also this, there's absolutely a component of having a chip on my shoulders that I have to go prove something.
Oh, okay.
Right? And there's absolutely that. Like that thing, there's the hidden force, and it's a big, big, big driver. Right? It's the force that you don't see, you don't know.
Yes.
And when you see it, you're like, holy shit. And you get a glimpse of it. Like I get a glimpse of it sometimes. Like, yeah. Oh, that's where that is coming from.
Wow.
Interesting. There is nowhere to stop that train.
Wow. So chip on your shoulder. And do you mean by that you just have this desire to be successful, or is it just, okay. All right. And I know we talked a little bit beforehand. I mean, yeah, of course you had a bunch of friends that were doing all these startups, and I had a bunch of friends too. I think that's probably what got me into it, because they're like, why would you do anything else? Look at all the opportunity here. Like you're in Silicon Valley. Why would you go to a big company? Mm-hmm. Within your peer group, I mean, obviously there's the Founders Network peer group, but those original friends that got you into Cloudera, right? Was it Cloudera?
Cloudera,
yeah. Are they, what are they doing? Are they still kind of part of your peer group? And
yeah, I'm in touch with a bunch of them. You know, some of them have gone on to build consulting businesses, some have gone on to build product companies, some have gone on to join you know, the cloud providers like Amazon and Google, and sort of risen up the you know, some have risen up the technical ladder, some have risen up the business ladder, and they're yeah, so they're all doing great. the founders have, you know, one of them is retired, the other one is at Google, and yeah, so the management team is just all over the place. All over the place, as in like they've gone on to do other things since. Yeah, so I'm absolutely in touch with a lot of those folks. I wouldn't say that was the peer group that drove me in this direction. I think I was definitely inspired by some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the desire to go build a company, or the desire to, or the hunger to succeed, that did not necessarily start by that exposure. I think that was probably already there. And this peer group probably gave me the opportunity to actually explore that. And also get exposed to what, you know, what building a company might look like. what the Silicon Valley game might even look like.
Yeah, there's a lot to learn. There's a lot that you can go wrong.
Exactly.
Interesting. Because I always try to figure out, like, you know, what was my first and main motivation? Because again, same thing, like not really an entrepreneurial background, not a really entrepreneurial family. The thing I think that really kind of hit it on the head for me is watching my dad and what my dad did. So what he did was he worked for United Airlines. He was in charge of doing like the autopilot and the navigation. Like he was an engineer, but anytime like something would go wrong, the FAA has got these airworthiness directives, just for you geeks out there that are into aviation. And anytime one of these directives would come down, they have to figure out how to fix it, or, you know, whatever. So he was in charge of writing the procedures and protocols for the technicians, which the aircraft and power plant mechanics to go fix. So I would see him, I mean, they would call him at all hours of the day and night to go literally get on a plane and go to Chicago or go to Denver and fix, get, you know, be there to kind of fix a plane and then literally come back. And I just remember as a kid, he would always get he'd get phone calls all the time. And he just didn't, I mean, he loved what he did, but I'm like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to get on the plane in the middle of the night, you know? Cause the one thing that working for the airlines afforded us as kids, which not a lot of kids have the opportunity to fly all over the country for basically nothing. No other kid that I know of at like 12 or 13 got to fly first class to London, right? I mean, because it was cheaper. I mean, it was cheap, right? So, you know, we would routinely like fly to Hawaii just because we could and it was cheap, right? You know? But I never thought, I really don't want to do that. And I think that maybe was part of it. But then, yeah, I think you're right. The hunger was there for me as well. But just seeing it, like, oh, this is possible? Oh, wow. Really?
Makes it more tangible, right?
Yeah. Because when you're, I think that's the reason why Founders Network appeals to me. In a lot of this peer mentoring and the other groups that I kind of belong to or kind of adjacent to is when you're around people that like believe and that are like, well, yeah, of course we could do that. Like you get inspired to be like, oh, well, maybe I could do that too. That is probably one of the most powerful motivators. I mean, I have sort of the chip on the shoulder too. like, why can't I do this? How come these knuckleheads are successful and I'm not? You know what I mean? You know, because it's hard, but you know it's not that hard. And so you know, there's a lot of luck. Like, oh no,
it's a lot of luck.
You got lucky. Don't ever say that you're like the more skilled than anyone else. You got lucky. Just admit it, right? Because you know they all do. You go talk to the guys with the huge exits and everything and gals as well. And they'll be like, oh yeah, I worked hard, but boy, I got lucky. I was at the right place at the right time. This is what this job is. Right place, right time, right skill set. Take advantage of opportunity.
You know, speaking of that lucky piece, right? I was reading something that an investor wrote on LinkedIn. And he said that I can never tell if a founder will be successful. Whether they're first time, second time, third time, doesn't really matter, right? I can never tell if they'll be successful, but I can usually tell if they will not be successful.
Right?
And the point that this person makes there is that they can, because they can't tell, you know, luck, market.
It's random.
How does the execution play out? There's like so many different factors.
There's so many variables.
Founder being successful, but if the founder doesn't have the hunger and the desire to learn and the curiosity, the chances that they will not succeed are significantly higher, right? If they don't bring curiosity to the table, if they don't bring hunger to the table, right? They're not going to.
Their
chances of success are just much lower.
That's a really good.
So this guy says that, like, I can't figure out if. He gives an example. He says a first time founder who's been super successful and is doing a second company. Oftentimes, and it's not always the case, but oftentimes you'll notice may not have the hunger, may not have the desire to really, like the chip on the shoulders that we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
I haven't been successful. I have a lot to prove. So I'm going to hunker down versus, oh, you know what? I built that thing. I sold it for $100 million and I'm going to take it. I know how to do it, right? So there's a little bit of arrogance that kicks in
Yeah.
So I think that's the point that this investor is trying to make. It kind of makes a lot of sense.
No, I agree. I mean, Jason Calacanis said something about that on the Knowledge Project podcast. He was interviewed by Shane Parrish, which is probably one of my, if not my favorite, I mean, top three, and just love what he does. And this podcast, I stole a lot of what he did from there, from this one, because I'm like, I love what you do. And he was saying that he was... they were talking about this whole movement of not working hard or not being hungry. Sure. And he's like, you know what? It usually comes from people that are already successful. And they, you know, they're like, oh, you don't need to work hard. And you're like, well, you're already successful. So, you know, when you talk about like the work-life balance and all that sort of stuff, which is a big component of burnout and people not taking care of themselves. And, you know, depending on your age and where you are in your journey. It's always funny because there are some times where you just got to work hard. And the reason you got to work hard is because you have no idea what you're doing. So if you don't know what you're doing, you're going to need to make a lot of mistakes and work hard. But his point was, I think, was really valid because, you can say that now because you've already attained that. But there's other people that may want to do that. So you think, curiosity, hunger, those are sort of the two we touched on in terms of, you know, the traits and values and beliefs of at least what you think as entrepreneurs. Are there any others that you found that are particularly important?
Are you asking the question, are there things that I think helped me, be on the entrepreneurial journey and get to wherever I got to? Or are you asking the question that in general, what are the traits that I found to be?
I'm glad you clarified
I don't necessarily have all of
them. Right? Well, neither do I. I mean, I wrote a whole book on it and I hope to have at least some of them.
There you go. Right.
No, I would say, let's talk about the ones that you think you have. And then let's talk about the ones that you're either working on or feel that's important, you know, to have. So why don't we start there?
One of the things that I consider as a strength of mine is I'm very coachable and reflective in nature. I solicit feedback actively, and I'm very open to what people have to tell me about, you know, what I'm doing well or not doing well, or what's working, what's not working. That tied with the curiosity and the desire to learn and desire to succeed actually makes for a good combination. I can adjust my path and approach pretty quickly. Of course, I have to believe that that's the right direction to go. But once I'm convinced, I can adjust pretty quickly. So I think that definitely helped me quite a bit because there were several occasions in building my previous startup where I was doing things that I had never done before, right? Or never even seen being done before. That's, for example, figuring out the go-to-market motion for an enterprise product, what the messaging should be. I've never been part of coming up with the messaging for a product and what the go-to-market motion should be. Yeah. How do you do PR and how do you do marketing? How do you launch a company? Well, what do I know?
Exactly.
And so, but we were pretty good at getting that, cracking the nut on that. Now, of course, it took some time. It took some effort. I thought a lot. I ended up spending some money. Some might argue I spent more money than I should have. Some might argue that I spent less money than I should have. It doesn't really matter. The point is that I figured it out. Mm-hmm. And produced a certain set of results. And the results were pretty good in some ways. And that only happened because I was taking inputs and seeking inputs from people all along, always. So that helped. That's a trait that I would say, be reflective, be coachable, seek advice, seek inputs, respect that other people have certain experiences that you can learn from. And there's always others who have more experiences to learn from. The flip side of that is something that that I have as a trait, which I don't think is the most helpful, is I can be arrogant. And the desire to prove, the desire to succeed, color the way I operate sometimes. Like I'm too full-headed and focused on the success and sort of my viewpoint, and I can be stubborn about it, and I can be arrogant about it. So the way I balance that is, just have a bunch of people around me that I trust. Mm-hmm. And then tell me, all right, are you being a jackass right now?
I prefer knucklehead. I've got those people too. Like, you're being a knucklehead. You should really.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like, okay. Yeah. Fine. Noted. I'll back off. Having coaches, essentially people you trust to give you the input in that moment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I've been fortunate to have a few people like that around me. Including my wife, like she'll just tell me straight up. Mm-hmm. Okay, now you're being an ass. Okay. So those are the set of traits that, good and bad. Another trait that helped me was I tend to not give up easily, right? So perseverance and pushing through things, and basically finding a way to make it work, finding a solution, right? So somebody, I remember talking to somebody who said, so you're like a pathfinder. You have an end goal in mind and you just find a way to get there.
Wow.
So yeah, that resonates. That description resonates. I usually set my eyes on something and then I'll find a way to get there.
Huh. That's interesting. Yeah.
And yeah, that was the first time I ever thought about it like that. There is a flip side of it. It is, I don't know when to stop or give up. Right. So the bullheaded nature and the arrogance and like single maniacal focus on the end goal, you combine all of that and you like, it's time to give up. This is not working.
Yeah.
No, well, stop. Okay, least... that way of engaging with that person is not going to work. No. I'll just like continue at it.
Well, at least you can admit it. Some people can't admit it.
Yeah. When when life slaps you in the face and the butt and all over the place, and you kind of say, okay, that did not work.
Nope.
You come out bruised and say, okay, that did not work.
Yeah. I think it was Marvin Liao, the ex-investor in 500 startups. Says, we only learn from pain. And I'm like,
absolutely.
Whew, yeah, probably true. But
that
he,
is very true. I
mean, yeah. He had a great line.
Great Alu says, it's like pain plus reflection is equal to growth.
Yeah. Yeah. He had, well, because, you know, I was part of their accelerator. And I mean, I really like Marvin. I like his style. It's sort of my style. But I'm like, yeah, Marvin, you know, you used to give me great advice. He's like, yeah, it's like getting hit in the head with a brick advice. And I'm all,
right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. And once you've been through a few of those experiences, I think a trait that then develops is just the humility and knowing that you're not.
Yeah. You don't know everything. Yeah.
You don't know everything. In fact, you probably don't know much.
Yeah, I always tell managers, like especially new managers or new leaders, they're all like, "Whoa, oh, I'm in charge." I go, "No. You have no idea what's going on, and two, you have no control." And they're like, "What do you mean I'm the boss?" I'm like, "You're the boss for now. Like, don't even think for a second that if you tell someone what to do, they're going to do it. You think you're the boss. You're not. You're there to coach and help and get out of the enable. You cannot be a dictator. And if you are, it'll last for a little while. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you'll be like, why is no one doing anything? Well, they'll rebel. I mean, even like the military, special forces guys, all those, if you talk to all of them about leadership and how they do things, you think, okay, command and control, you've got top down military. I mean, you've got family in the military. It's probably similar. There's a point where they give orders, but the real true leaders are not giving orders. The commander's intent is what they call it. This is what we got to do. How are we going to do it? And those are the ones that succeed and survive. The ones that are authoritarian quickly, they're like, I'm not going to do that. You know, like, anyway.
Yeah. And there's something to be said about the top-down authoritative commanding way of leading. There are moments when that is appropriate.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
In wartime, it is not about consensus and all of us feeling good and, right? Like, what do you think? And what do you think? And what do you think? That's not how you go to war. It's like, this is what we're going to go do. You go here. We attack this way. This is the strategy. Go. Right? But in order to be successful at that, you need to have the trust of the team. And the trust of the team gets built over time. Right? In the military, there is an inherent trust. Like because of the structure. And in a company, there is no inherent trust.
Right.
You have to build that into the culture. And that's incredibly hard to do.
It is. It's one of the hardest.
Especially a new manager coming in and you know, suddenly you've got five people and a new manager managing the team. And hey, do you trust them? Of course not. Or do you trust that person? Of course not.
No.
They're likely going to be, the default is going to be rebelling.
Yeah. Well, they're going to push. It's like, it's actually almost like little kids. Kids will push the boundaries of new adults and new situations to see where the boundaries are.
Right.
That's how they learn. That's how, I mean, not a lot of people learn that way, but you can see the same reaction where you'll see the people that are trying to be in good favor. So they're going to like kiss up, you're going to be the ones that are rebelling. You're going to be the ones that are sort of laying low and, and they're like, they're injured or they're wary of any kind of different management because they either like the old person, who knows, right? But so, so that dynamic is very interesting. Huh. Those are really good ones. What are some ones that you aspire to work on or that you would want?
Well, I think I have a way longer list.
We'll start with the top three. I mean, it's always good to have a top three list.
Yeah, so I did do a great job of building accountability into the system at my previous company. So, you know, that's the highest level to capture a variety of different things that I think I would want to do a better job of. So, for example, that goes from enabling people, letting them run with full autonomy, but then being accountable for the end goal that we're all shooting towards, and then trusting that they will do the right things, and come back and ask for help when they don't know what to do or run into some sort of a problem or need help, like need support. They need somebody else to help them out or whatever. So I don't think I did a good job. I'm pretty sure. I'm 100% sure that I did not do a good job of building accountability into the organization the way I would have liked. The way it manifested was a lot of things would bubble up to me to fix or to solve. That needed to reduce over time, but it did not to the degree that I would have aspired to see. And I don't necessarily know what specific things I could have done differently just yet, right? Like every time I think about the entire experience, I can come up with a couple of different things that are different than, you know, my previous instance of reflecting on it. So I think I see nuances every time I think about it. So I haven't yet settled on exactly what that looks like. So that's something that I aspire to do much better is build accountability, be more hands-off in nature, be more enabling in nature versus more doing in nature. And then along with the enablement comes the accountability piece. And so a broad set of things that I've captured in that.
That's a hard one to work on.
Right. And the thing that I wonder is that is there a way to learn that short of doing it again and paying attention to it. Right? You can't go read a book on it.
Hard to read a book on that. Yeah. It's a skill that has to be practiced in a safe environment where failure is tolerated.
Right.
And it's a culture thing, actually. It's a really hard culture thing. And, I mean, this is a problem. Okay, I wouldn't call it a problem. This is a skill that all entrepreneurs, especially early stage entrepreneurs, need to work on because most of the stuff's rattling around in their head, right? Like, this is the vision. How come you can't read my mind? Right. Well, because I can't read your mind. And they always want to put their finger in everything. And when you're a small team of 5 to 10, works.
That's fine.
Yeah. As it scales, people just get frustrated because and the entrepreneur gets frustrated too because they know in their heart that they have to do it.
Yeah.
They're either scared or don't know how, or they're so worried about failure that they're, it's fear. It's really is fear.
Yeah. So that desire, remember what I'll tell you, share an experience there, share the story. So, the fear of failure, the flip side of that is the hunger and the desire to succeed, which we talked about earlier, right? Like I have to succeed and there's just the hunger and the drive and the desire to succeed. Along with that comes the fear of failure. Whichever one leads doesn't really matter, but they're both present together typically, right? at least in my case, they were more present together. About a year ago, maybe a little more than that, actually, maybe about a year and a half ago, I was doing an offsite with the entire company. We were about 25 people at the time, 25 people, something like that. And then you know, we were doing these exercises on communication and working through some problems together, some collaboration, was doing some team building work. And four people on the team, three folks in the organization, people I respect, you know, they pulled me aside and sat me down. So the exercise, I think if I remember correctly, the exercise would go and talk to somebody that you're having a hard time collaborating with.
Or
there's some communication that you want to deliver to them in the interest of collaboration, and you know, we'll talk to them about that. So these three sit me down and say, "So we need to talk to you."
Whoa.
And I'm thinking, "Oh shit!" I'm
not feeling the love here.
all three of them are like sitting in front of me.
Yeah.
And so when you said you've hired us. Now let go.
Wow.
Right. Like straight conversation, straight to my face.
Wow.
And they said, let go.
Wow.
Like, trust that we know what we're doing.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that was the most, I was so grateful for that conversation
for
multiple reasons. One, that it showed me something that I wasn't seeing, like something that I was doing wrong. That it gave me a view into that. Second, that all three of them felt comfortable.
That's
it. Wasn't that they had this giant plan?
No, that's a big deal.
Deliberating, right?
That's a big deal.
Straight away, just came and said what they needed to say. Right. So it gave me.
Wow.
It was actually, it was almost a gift.
Yeah. Oh, no, it is.
Like, I see that conversation as a gift.
Yes.
And it made me believe that that I did well in building that culture of communication and transparency, such that they were able to come in and confront me on something that they would have otherwise felt, or it would be natural to feel uncomfortable.
Oh, that's an incredibly uncomfortable conversation to have.
With the CEO, right?
You're
CEO,
oh yeah, so, oh yeah. I mean, you live in, you know, CEOs live in a bubble, right?
Right, exactly. And these guys are perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And then there was nothing after that. Like, we just went back to just being completely normal, as if that was a normal conversation to be had. Like, there was no lingering tension around it. How will he react? What is going to happen? Like, yeah, got it. I see it. I see your point. I totally get it. I can see where I'm making the mistake. Here's where my concerns are. Here's my fear. This is likely what's at the core of it. Let's figure it out. I want to do better. Let's figure it out and, you know, come back to me and tell me if I'm still doing the same thing in 2 weeks. And then we went out and had drinks and dinner together. Right? So it was a pretty awesome experience.
Yeah.
To have when people did that.
No, I mean, wow, that's a great story. And I mean, and I will say that is a testament to having a culture that's open.
Yeah.
That conversation doesn't happen a lot in companies.
Right. Right.
People are afraid, especially if they're below the boss. And you know, there's a reason why CEOs are in the bubble.
Right.
The ones in the bubble are the ones that don't take bad news well.
Right. Yeah.
They just don't like the feedback. They don't want to know. Politicians have this problem too. There's just a bunch of yes people around them because they see the reaction. And what's interesting is, as the boss, you think what you say is like, well, I'm just who I am. But whatever you say gets amplified by 10x.
Yeah. I never learned that. That's the one thing
I learned that one the hard way, by the way. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Really hard, hard. Because, you know, words matter.
Yeah.
The meaning behind words matter. The tone, right. The tenor, of especially leadership. Like, if they don't know who you are, or they're, you know, trying to get favor, because everyone's sort of jockeying for position.
Right.
I mean, especially any organization, any, sure. You know, they have a joke if you're Hungarian, that what do you call two Hungarians arguing together? They're three political parties, because they're all kind of, you know, that's the way it is, right? Everything is, you know, dynamic, and there's a history there. Same with bosses, you know, really hard to be open and take in all that, because part of your job is to sort of filter that and you know where you're going, right. And it's hard to sometimes communicate that.
Yeah.
And depending on how you handle that uncertainty, people will literally, they look to the boss. So if the boss is freaking out, that's not a good thing.
I never learned that.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, this is why we talk about it. If the way the boss handles bad news, the way I always think of it is, every word I say, if I'm in charge, every word I say is going to be amplified and taken out of context, and the expansion of it is going to be order of magnitude worse than I think. And that may seem extreme, but it's actually a really good rule of thumb, because I remember people will take things out of context, or they'll hear snippets or some off-color comment will impact people, and they will spin up for a day or two.
Right. Yeah, that happened on several different occasions at my company.
Yeah.
And the idea that I said I never learned that, but I would say it a little differently, that was something that I didn't do a good job of. There were occasions when I did not do a good job of that. So what I mean by that is, there were moments when I would say things that would be perfectly fine saying to a peer, right?
Yeah.
And I'm generally a very, very transparent and an open person. Like, I don't try to hide things.
Right.
In fact, quite the opposite. Like, I believe in full transparency.
Mm-hmm.
But that full transparency actually freaks people out. Right. If not put in context.
Yeah.
Right. The context is extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And if not put in context, it freaks people out. And so I would be very, very transparent about, you know, challenges in some place, and you know, customer challenge or whatever the challenge is. But not realizing that I am still thinking through the problem, and part of what I'm sharing is my current thinking. If I don't let the other person know that I'm sharing my current thinking and not necessarily the conclusion of that thinking, they don't know what to do with it, right? So the context is missing for them in terms of where the thought process is right now, and whether they should help, or whether the expectation is that they would help, or do they take the, like, is it a blame on them? Right.
Yeah.
Is it a failure for of one of their peers? Like, any number of those things could be, just depending on what your worldview is.
Yeah.
Your mind would go wherever it would go.
Totally.
So not framing the right context can actually create fear. And it's happened on several different occasions. Like, I couldn't figure out what's going on. People want me to be transparent. I'm being transparent. Now what's the problem? And then later on, I realized, oh, yeah, they don't have the context.
They don't have the context. Yeah.
And I cannot operate as if I'm just one of their peers. As much as I want to be, I'm still their boss. I'm still the CEO of the company. And I cannot pretend or operate as if I'm not.
Yeah. No.
Like, I'm not their buddy in this conversation. I'm not their buddy. We could be friends.
Right.
But that's a different role at a different time. And this is not the conversation to be had as friends.
Right. Right. Wow. I'm on deep.
Yeah,
that
I made a few mistakes on this.
This has been a great conversation. I really appreciate your time. I mean, you know, stay safe, and you know, I'm confident you'll keep working on stuff. Like, I'll be keep working on stuff.
Right. We're all work in progress.
We all are work in progress. That's so true. All right, I'll talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to the Entrepreneur Ethos podcast. I hope you enjoyed this episode as much as I did creating it. My hope is that you learned something that can make you a little bit better. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do share it with friends and review it on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. You can also join my email list by visiting thedailymba.com to get my thoughts on what I'm doing to get better, as well as what I'm working on. You can also pick up my book, The Entrepreneur Ethos, if you want to learn the traits, values, and beliefs that I think we need to build a more ethical, inclusive, and resilient entrepreneur, and frankly, world community. Feel free to follow me on Twitter at TheDailyMBA and let me know if you have any questions or recommendations for a guest that you'd like me to talk to. Also, drop me a note if you try anything we talked about in this or any other episode. I'd love to hear what's working for you. Until next time, keep getting better.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE system.